You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Oscar and Golden Globe winning actor Matthew McConaughey is well known for his roles in movies like Dazed and Confused, A Time to Kill, The Wolf of Wall Street, Dallas Buyers Club, and season 2 of the HBO series True Detective. But he's also a poet, a backroad adventurer, a philosopher, a global explorer, an occasional orchestra conductor, a husband and father of three, a people person, and a passionate student of life. Indeed, he's been trying to work out the riddle of life for most of his 50 years on this planet, and he's been keeping diaries of clues to that riddle for the last 35. Diaries that include notes about successes and failures, joys and sorrows, things that made him marvel, and things that made him laugh out loud. How to be fair, how to have less stress, how to have fun, how to hurt people less, and how to get hurt less. How to be a good man, how to have meaning in life, and how to become more himself. Recently, he worked up the courage to sit down with those diaries again, and he found stories he experienced, lessons he learned and forgot, poems, prayers, prescriptions, beliefs about what matters, some great photographs, and a whole bunch of bumper stickers. And along the way, he also found a reliable theme, an approach to living that gave him more satisfaction at the time and still today. He shares it all in his new book called Green Lights, and Matthew McConaughey joins me on the podcast today to discuss what he calls the wild rodeo marriage of his mom and dad, the moment when he became a man in his father's eyes, and the long line of bullshitters, hustlers, and riverboat gamblers in the McConaughey family tree. He talks about landing his first role in Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused, the line that opened up the character of Wooderson for him, and how an improvised line in a scene that wasn't even supposed to take place became the catchphrase that has followed him ever since. He recalls going from total anonymity to a celebrity in the span of just 48 hours, stepping away from Hollywood for 20 months at the peak of his success in order to land the kind of serious roles that he really wanted, and the long road to his Academy Award-winning performance in the Dallas Buyers Club. Plus, Matthew talks about healing our nation's divisions, finding our tribe and our shared values, and whether he just might want to run for office himself one day. Coming up with Matthew McConaughey in just a moment. Now, folks, I could tell you all the stuff that you already know about Matthew McConaughey and list his credits like Dazed and Confused, Wolf of Wall Street, Dallas Buyers Club, and so on, but I think I'd prefer to just give you the short little bio on the flap of his new book, Green Lights. It says, Academy Award-winning actor Matthew McConaughey is a married man, a father of three children, and a loyal son and brother. He considers himself a storyteller by occupation, believes it's okay to have a beer on the way to temple, feels better with the day's sweat on him, and is an aspiring orchestral conductor. Matthew, is that a pretty good summary of your priorities in life there?
Hey, I'm doing all right. That's where I'm headed.
Orchestral conductor. What's the deal on that?
Conductor. Well, I produced a couple of albums with the reggae artist years ago, and they'd worked with many different producers, and when I would be in the studio and actually conducting and dancing and moving and waving my hands and pointing right here, bring it up. That's when they said it was the easiest and the best for them to play the music. And so I've gone on and I've got out those aspirations. I've even been given a couple of whatever you call them, the wands. And,
oh, yeah.
I'll probably start off in the church and move from there and see if I get to see if I get to Carnegie Hall.
Well, man, I really enjoyed your book here, Green Lights, because I'm pretty close to the same age as you, Matthew, and I grew up around Texas around the same time as you. So, you know, your dad was in the oil business. Mine was in the oil business. So a lot of these memories of the oil boom in the 80s resonate with me, as well as the stuff about Dazed and Confused, because I can remember, you know, that was a huge deal in Texas at the time. That really kicked off the whole explosion of the indie film scene in Austin. So this book brought back a lot of memories for me. Those were a unique couple of decades in Texas, I guess, weren't they?
Indeed. Yeah. Yes, they were. Where were you exactly?
Southwest of Houston, little town called Richmond Rosenberg.
Yeah.
The twin cities of nowhere, basically.
I hear you.
Yeah, and you were where? In Uvalde?
I started off Uvalde, which is southwest San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
Moved out of there when it got too big, because I remember the day we moved out, it was almost 12,000 people. A Wendy had come to town, and we were like, whoa, Wendy. Hey, anyway, no, we moved to Longview, which wasn't much bigger town because the oil boom. Longview was actually the fastest growing city in the nation at that time.
Right.
Because people were flocking in. And Dad went from working for somebody to within 3 months in Longview had a staff of 24, 26 men working under him at Bauer Steel. Yeah. That it was his.
Wow. Yeah. That was the time you could go from nothing to something overnight. Yeah. I remember. Yeah.
Get the Learjet. Come on. Let's run.
Yeah. I remember. Like I said, my dad was in the oil business too. And he used to always refer to East Texas rednecks and not in a derisive way, in a very loving way. Did you guys consider yourselves East Texas rednecks?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We were stuck over there behind. It's called the Pine Curtain.
Okay.
For instance, you know, west of us, 2.5 hours west is Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I went to Dallas, and now mind you, I was in Longview for 10 years. I went to Dallas like twice. That was Paris, France, man. That was that was another country. Yeah. And remember, we come back, we're like, they use a lot more hairspray over there. And you had to pass Tyler on the way, and Tyler, Texas, on the way.
Yeah, good barbecue.
Yeah, absolutely. We didn't get out. We didn't leave that Pine Curtain. I probably, if anything, went east towards Shreveport and crossed over in Louisiana more than I actually went to Dallas. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dallas way, and Dallas sort of considered us those East Texas rednecks behind the Pine Curtain. We wore that flag with pride.
Right. Then you go from being an East Texas redneck to being a coon ass, as my dad would say. Now I've constantly nowadays had to explain that calling someone a coon ass is not like calling someone a coon, which is a racial slur. Coon ass is the Louisiana equivalent of a redneck.
Right? Yes, exactly. And they and I haven't met a coon ass yet that feels that's derogatory toward him if you call him one. They take with pride.
Yeah, that's true. Now, I love the book. And it's not just a straight-up memoir. It also has poems by you. I didn't even know you write poetry. You have thoughts on your values and observations, lots of great photos in here, and a bunch of journal entries that span, I think, about 35 years of your life. When did you start journaling, and what was your original intent with that? What were you trying to get out of that when you were young?
Well, I think I started journaling, like, you know, about 13, 14 years old, like any youngster, you know, writing stuff down like, why did Gretchen break up with me? And, you know, why am I getting all these pimples and that, you know, all this stuff.
The usual reasons.
That kind of thing. Yeah. They, you know, that sort of go to it, try to figure, wondering what the hell's going on. And then I just continued it and started and continued writing in it when actually things were going well. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you know, for instance, in college, I had a couple of years ago where my relationships were in great shape. I had 4 handicap. I was making grades, so mom and dad were happy. I had a job, I had cash in my pocket. I was kind of rolling. And I remember thinking, oh, you should write now. You make sure you keep writing things down now, because you're going to want to maybe dissect what you were doing when you felt successful.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to maybe want to dissect that later on when you're in a rut again. And boy, I found that to be really helpful that I was able at times when I would get off my frequency again later in life to go back and go, what were your habits when you were rolling? Who were you hanging out with? Yeah. Where were you going? What were you eating? What were you drinking? How much sleep were you getting? How were you greeting the day, et cetera, et cetera. And I was able to sometimes help myself recalibrate and get back on track by looking back at the times.
I wonder, have all those journals and this introspection ever come in handy with your acting, help you prepare for a role or something?
Oh yeah. Really? I still keep journals and on every single, I have a journal for every that I've kept on every single movie that I've done. Oh, really? And I'm not writing about, it's not really about the movie. It's how am I seeing the world through the character I'm playing's eyes. Mm-hmm. So, I've got some really good life stuff that I've learned when I'm writing things down on the set of a movie of a character I'm playing. Mm-hmm. But I mean, every, you know, sports have been big. The preparation for sports is very much like what I do. Mm-hmm. You just, you go out, it's a, yes, I am the one in front of the camera, the light's on me. I better have my playbook. I better know my playbook upside down and backwards and feel comfortable for anything to happen, be able to call proverbial audible while the camera's rolling. At the same time, there's about 120 people in the crew that have to be great at what they're doing for what I'm doing to work. So it is a team. It's a big, well-oiled machine. When it's working well, it's incredible team play to make it work, to make a good film or to pull off a successful day of filming, and a successful week, a successful month, a successful 3 months of filming. But it's also at the same time an individual sport. Everybody better be the expert at what they're doing and have their best day for everyone to succeed.
Does it feel like a lot of pressure? You're the guy who has to carry a movie. You know, at one point you weren't. You were just starting out. But now you are the guy, and it rides on your shoulders, and box office rises and falls, sure. And a good part of that's on you. That must feel like a lot of pressure.
Yeah, but I prefer it that way. Mm-hmm. I definitely prefer it that way. Here's a good example I worked on this one film, Killer Joe, and William Friedkin, the director, comes up, and day one, comes up to the, brings over the whole cast. He goes, okay, new rule on set. He goes, one take. You get one take, nothing more. Well, you immediately go, oh, you know, you get a little tight, but then all of a sudden you can either stay tight or you can go, oh, look at the freedom in that. Mm-hmm. Yep. One take. Let it all rip. Let it hang out right now. Don't hold anything back. Be prepared and just, and there can become great freedom in that idea that there's only one take.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's the way that's also the fun to answer your question of if I'm the lead in the film, I like to carry that baton. I like to feel like, here we go. We got one take and let's do it our way. Now, look, does it also matter how the film does? Sure. You know, I'm the one that sometimes the studio's relying on to go sell and market the movie. There becomes little things. And then that still doesn't guarantee that the movie does well.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So then you're measured on how the box office do. And that's where I talk about this in the book. In Hollywood, it's like most things in business. It's not personal. Mm-hmm. It's business. I mean, and so if the movie does well, yes. Yeah. I could have done the same work in the movie, right? Mm-hmm. The exact same work could be a bomb or a major success.
Right, right. You earned your paycheck.
You've earned it, but the paycheck will be higher or lower next time based on what the movie made, not how good we internally thought the movie was.
Yeah. I wonder if that whole one take thing works well for you, because I have to say you've always seemed like a guy who is pretty authentic in every performance that you've done. Everything that we see seems like there's some touch of truth to it about you.
Hope so.
You don't seem like a guy who's had much use for acting classes. I'll put it that way.
Well, no, I haven't, but I did learn. I worked with the Lady Penny Allen for 19 years, starting in 1997. Yeah. But look, I mean, that's, you know, what's the biggest compliment that I can get as an actor, I think any actor could get, is that after every single role, people come up and go, that was you. You weren't acting. That's the biggest compliment you can get. It's again, like any athlete, if you're going to master something, mastering something gets to where it looks absolutely simple. Mm-hmm. And you don't see the work in the play. You don't see... you don't see me thinking about it. You don't see a great performer thinking about what they're doing, just as you don't see a great athlete for thinking about what they're doing.
Right. It's the whole myth of effortlessness.
Yeah. And what you don't see is all the ground and pound and sweat that I break 2 months leading up to the role.
Yeah.
That's when I'm working. Once I show up set, I'm playing. I'm like four-dimensionally press record. Give me whatever you want. I'm ready. And I've thrown the playbook out. You know, I just know it upside down and upside and backwards. So,
yeah, I love the section in here where you talk about all the preparation that you did to be a dragon slayer in Reign of Fire. Is it true that you really were tackling cows?
Yes.
And running barefoot in the desert?
Well, you're going to go play a dragon slayer, right? Yeah. What would I do? I'm going to go out to my brother's ranch. Spend 2 months out there and I get these bright ideas. Yeah, I'm going to wake up. I'm going to have a double shot of Cuervo right when I wake up at sunrise. You know, well, I'm gonna go run. It was summertime too, and it's out in West Texas.
And
I'm
barefoot. Yikes!
In West Texas.
Yeah.
And you know that ground out there. It's not like soft sand or.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I go. I'm gonna run 2.5 miles out, 2.5 miles back, and then at night after I eat dinner under moonlight, I'm gonna go out and start in wrestling cows and knock them over. Well, though, as you see in the book, those plans backfired on me pretty quickly. I wasn't able to do that for 2 months, much less 2 weeks. I got injured pretty quickly.
And plus the movie wouldn't have been able to have that little PETA approval at the end of the credits, you know. So, no animals were harmed in the making of this movie.
Well, they harmed me back, so they got even.
Right? Okay. You open this book with what for most people would seem like a pretty dark scene of near domestic violence. And you later talk about how your dad came to blows with your brother at some point and even challenged you to fight him. For a lot of folks, this kind of stuff would be the kind of scarring events that would send them into therapy for years. But you seem to have taken it in stride, like kind of like that's just how mom and dad are. How did you process all that stuff?
Well, it is how mom and dad were.
Yeah.
I mean, they had a rodeo or relationship. It was a bull ride. You know, their relationship, they were divorced twice, married three times to each other. I mean, there's a good example of how rocky of a road they liked. That was they wanted to have a couple more honeymoons. So they said, well, let's just get divorced. You know what I mean? So I can really look forward to seeing you again when you come back. And there's no sentimentality about it. I mean, look, the love that my mom and dad had for each other, the passion that they had for each other, the love that my mom and dad showed me and my two brothers was never ever in question. So these things that you could look at on paper and go, geez, that looks abusive. Geez, call Child Protection Services. Geez, McConaughey, you must have had therapy for the past 40 years. No, no, and no. And I think it's because the love was never in question. It's just how my mom and dad communicated. Mm-hmm. And trust me, my dad was not challenging me to a fight because that was a one-way ticket to a loss if that would have happened.
Right. You were smart enough to know that.
Same with my older brother. If dad really wanted a fight, dad's going to win. What he wanted us is to accept the challenge of saying, hey, you know, for my instance in the book is I lied to him and he gave me four chances to get out of that lie, but I weaseled. And I was so deep in it that I lied even the one more time. And that's when he challenged. And, you know, you read the story in the book, but I remember that story. It wasn't, you know, him saying, hey, come on, I'll give you four to my one shot across the kisser. If I would have hit him the one time, if I'd hit him four times, he would have never hit me the one time. All he wanted me to do was maybe just get ready to strike him the first time. And then give him a good look. And then he'd have gone like, gosh, dang, boy, that's pretty good. Right. Come here, buddy. Yeah. That was it. You know what I mean? He was never going to hit me.
Yeah.
It was just accepting that challenge that he wanted me and you
turned down that challenge. So what was the rite of passage for you? When did you become a man in dad's eyes?
Well, there was a moment that was a bit of a rite of passage and it did have to do with a physical altercation. It was, he and I were, I think I was around 20 or so. I don't know. We were coming out of a bar and over there near where you live. We were around Sugarland.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That was right by me.
Yeah. And we'd had a couple beers and we were walking out and this big jacked up, kind of roared up bouncer steps in front of my dad. And as I had already walked out, puts a hand up to stop and goes, sir, did you pay your bill? And my dad goes, yeah, but, and we did pay our bill. And as my dad kept walking by, this guy put a hand out on my dad's chest. Ooh. And just as I saw the hand go to his chest and saw my dad guy start to look down, which dad was about to handle the guy, next thing I know, I'm being pulled off of the bouncer. And I've knocked him, the bouncer's on the ground 20 feet back inside the bar on his back on the ground. And it's my dad saying, that's enough, that's enough, that's enough, son.
So that was it.
Well, that was a big rite of passage. Yeah. I remember him calling all his buddies going, hey, because I'm the youngest one, right? I was the mama's boy. He's like, hey, the youngest one, he's going to be okay. He's going to be okay. He's got to switch it in. You got to watch it. Yeah. But it was, you know, the physicality was a bit of a rite of a passage. And that's, you know, that's a different, you know, the generation, you know, where we came from.
Sure.
And, you know, that was what it was. It was that I accepted that I did that I for the first time didn't try to talk my way out of it. Or, you know, remember I was going to be a lawyer. I was a good debater. I would always talk, and dad would be like, can you just quit talking and just go handle it, whatever the situation was. And I always be like, well, let me talk about it. And so that was important to him. Yeah.
And I love what it was with your brother. I think this was your older brother, Rooster. That whole fight between your dad and him came about because dad wanted him to go roll pipe with him in the middle of the night. Whoa, yeah. That rolling pipe, that's basically
rolling
like pipe, stealing
was
pipe, right?
Slang for, you take an empty 18 wheeler and you go across town late at night and you go get someone else's pipe on the back of the 18 wheeler and you basically steal it. Evidently dad and him had done that before. But this time dad knowingly challenged Rooster to go do that at the pipe yard where Rooster, dad's son, had just got the account of. So dad was doing a rite of passage of who are you loyal to? You know, your business, your new account in the job that I got you, or your old man. That was, and so dad knew what he was doing. And again, soon as in that fight, as soon as Rooster bucked up and meant it and came back at dad and that's when dad was like, that's my boy. I don't think dad ever, you know, Rooster was never going to go roll that pipe. And yeah. I don't think dad actually was ever going to go roll that pipe either. I think it was just a challenge.
Yeah.
Prove it to me.
Yeah.
You know, that you're going your own way. Prove it to me that you're going to make, you're going to stand up for yourself and step and not listen to your old man. That's what dad was getting at. That you're going to say, I'm man enough to say I'm not listening to you anymore, dad.
And you kind of have your own version of rolling pipe in here, too, because I forget how old you were, but at some point when you were living in East Texas, you would sneak out and steal 2x4s from a local lumber yard every night for a couple of months to build a treehouse out there. You claim that you built a 13-story treehouse. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true.
13 stories.
13 stories. I had so much plywood and 2x4s, and I built would cut the 2x4s and short for the ladder going up the trunk of the tree, and then just sawed out a little area where I could get through each level going up, climbing up the trunk. And in between, I also cut out holes in the platforms of each one where I had this pulley where I could show up and I'd have a little bucket tied to this long rope. And I put my paper bag lunch in the bottom of it. And then skimmy up to the top floor, 13th floor, so I could pulley up my lunch. And that, I remember I'd do that over and over and over. And it was just me. But I'd pulley it up there and get my lunch. And then I'd drop it back down, sit there and look around. And I'd sit there and talk to myself. Oh, I think I have my lunch. Oh, where's my lunch? Oh, I need to go down and get it. No, you don't need to go down and get it. You got a pulley. I remember talking. I'd pulley it back up. I was so proud of the
damn That's pulley. A little boy's dream right there.
Oh, it was awesome.
Yeah, I love all these stories from your childhood and, you know, the stories of your dad and your mom. You know, what was it, the mink oil or the oil of mink?
Oil of mink. Yeah. So mom's peddling this product, sort of a door-to-door, you know, oil of mink. You ought to have this for, you know, $29.99. You can have this. And so, I mean, she's got it. And it's a facial oil product. And the line was, put it on your face. It'll bring out all the impurities you have in your skin, but then they'll be gone forever and you will forever and infinitely have glowing, beautiful skin for the rest of your life. Well, back that time when I was like around 14, 15, you know, getting those pimples and stuff as any adolescent does, my mom goes, you know, well, maybe you should try the oil of mink. So I start putting that stuff on every night and the pimples start coming out more and more and more and more and more. And after about 2 weeks, it's bad. I mean, I've got, my cheeks are swollen. I look like a different person. And my mom's just like, boy, you have a lot of impurities in there, Matthew. Well, just keep doing it. It'll just pull them all out and you'll have beautiful glowing skin. I do it another week and a half. Well, now it gets so bad. I've got such bad acne. I sneak off without my mom's approval to a dermatologist. And the dermatologist says, what in the hell has happened to your face, Matthew? What are you putting in your face? And I show him, I pull out this bottle. I go, hey, it's this, oil of mink. And he looks at the label. He's like, no, you should never put this on your face. You're an adolescent. You're like 15 years old. Your pores are already secreting oil and this is blocking them up. This is for people 35 to 40 and older. He said, we got to get you on this stuff called Accutane. Or he said, you're 10 days away from having those ice pick holes that you have in your face.
Pockmarks.
Pockmarks. And so he got me on Accutane, which you got to be on for about a year and has its side effects. But I didn't give a damn about the side effects as long as it could clear up the shit I had. So around that time though, you know, dad got the idea of the bright idea of, hey, we're going to sue this company. Hey, come on, son. We're going to go down and talk to my lawyer buddy, Jerry Harris. I go down, Jerry. He's like, let me look at my boy. Jerry's like, geez, look at you, son. You look like hell. You look like, you're all swole up, son. He goes, what's this thing? And my dad's like, yeah, my Katie, his wife, been putting him on this product. It's all damn oil of mink. Doesn't say anything on here about not giving it to kids. And the damn dermatologist told him he shouldn't be doing that. It's blocking up his pores. I mean, we can make some money. And all of a sudden, Jerry goes, has this been a stressful time for you, Matthew? And I'm like, looked at my dad, and dad's like, and I'm like, yes, very stressful. He goes, has your confidence lowered, Matthew? I'm like, yes. He goes, how's it going with the girls? I'm like, well, not as good. And he's like, emotional distress. Jim, I think we can make 35 to 50 grand on this thing. No problem. We got a deal. So all of a sudden, now I go on the Accutane. And as lawsuits go, they take a while.
Yeah, sure.
A year and a half later, now the Accutane's worked. I've got my skin back. I'm clear. I'm now a senior in high school. All right. I get called in for the deposition with the defense lawyer back in Jerry Harris's office. And he sits there and he's sitting across the table. And he's looking at me. He's like, looking at these pictures of me all swollen up. And he's like, oh my gosh, look at you. Poor son. Poor. Oh, must've been so emotionally distressful for you. And I'm like, in my mind going, this guy's throwing me softballs. That's our case. Emotional distress. You know, and I'm like, yes, emotionally stressful. He said, how's your confidence? Some confidence was low. He said, how's it going with the girls? I said, not good. He goes, it's kind of scarred you for life, hadn't it? And I'm like, you know, it has. And right about that time, he reaches it on the table and pulls out this green, thick book that I notice immediately is a yearbook. He's got a page marked. He slides it over in front of me, opens it to that page, points to a picture, and he goes, who's that? And it was a picture of me that in my senior year, I just won most handsome. And just as I see that picture, I look up at him and he goes, scarred for life, huh? And I knew right then the case was done. And I mean, we've been home and I remember dad here walking around the house going, gosh, damn it, boy, we could have made $35,000 to $50,000. You got to go off and win most handsome and screw up the whole deal.
I love it. I mean, you have a whole section in here on outlaw logic and how you came from this long line of riverboat gamblers, cattle thieves, and at least one Al Capone bodyguard. Is it fair to say that the McConaughey family, maybe even Matthew included, has a little bit of larceny in them?
I looked at my family tree.
Yeah.
I went deep on it. Ancestry.com. There was no royalty. And that's putting it lightly. I look back and I was like, dang, you've done pretty good, Matthew. I even broke a chain in some places.
I think at one point you talk about the difference between bullshitters and liars, and you say you like bullshitters better than liars. What's the difference for you?
Well, a bullshitter can sit there in the middle of it and you'd see them start to tell the tall tale, but they're letting you know with the twinkle in their eye that you just can go with me here. You know, a liar is just trying to stick. No, this is exactly what happened. This is how I saw it. And they're going to, so the bullshitter lets you know they're lying in the way that they're bullshitting. So I love a good bullshitter. I trust a bullshitter over a liar.
We're going to take a quick break and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment.
Now, you'd ended up not becoming a lawyer. I think somewhere before you went into grad school, you decided that wasn't going to be for you, and you went to film school. Now, I went to film school as well, and I don't remember a lot of students with the looks and charisma of a Matthew McConaughey. How did you fit in at film school?
Well, at the beginning, not very well. I was full of it was the gothic kids at that time.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of people I got along with, but it was the gothic kids that didn't see the sun, you know. They were a bit cynical about things. They were kind of neurotic about things. I mean, I would go, you know, one of our classes was, you know, this weekend, go see a movie, come back, stand up, present it in front of the class, what you thought about it. And I'd go see Die Hard and I'd come back, you know, and I'd go, they would all go see the black and white Eisenstein revival.
Right. Sure.
Come back in and they'd sit in the corner. And so every time I'd go see like a blockbuster and come back in, I was the only one in class going to see the blockbuster. And as soon as I'd stop up and I'd step up and I go, hey, so I saw Die Hard this weekend or whatever the movie was, they'd be in the back of the class going like, shit, that's corporate sellout shit, man. Nah, Toro, that stuff sucks. And all of a sudden, and first couple of times, I'm like, dang it. Do I need to be seeing the Eisenstein revival too? You know what I mean? And they, you know, whatever it was, they'd cut it down before I even could explain it. And then this one day I got to class and I'd seen the blockbuster and I got up and I think it was Die Hard. I said, look, this one is a Die Hard. And they went like, shit, that's corporate sellout. They're all back in the back corner, you know? And all of a sudden I went, how do you know it's shit? What makes you say it's shit? And they're like, well, it just is. I go, did you see it? And they all went, it stopped them. They all got silent and went and looked at each other and like, well, no. I mean, we didn't see it. We just noticed. And all of a sudden I was like, you know, bullshit. You can't just say that, you know, and went off on them. And at that day, you know, I was already the frat guy in film school.
Yeah.
The only frat guy in film school. And so from that day on, I was like, F y'all, man, I don't mind seeing your Eisenstein revival, but at least I'll go see that. So quit cussing at my blockbuster over here that I liked, and I liked Die Hard. All right. Yeah. And I'll tell you why. So don't be sitting over there, you know, cutting it off at the legs when you hadn't even seen the damn thing. So we ended up getting along after that.
So you were mostly on the film track, not the acting track when you started out, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it was behind the camera. I knew I wanted to be in the storytelling business. Mm. I had been writing short stories, a lot of them that were in the journals, a lot of them that you see in the book now.
Yeah.
But I think secretly in the back of my mind, even subconsciously, I really wanted to be in front of the camera.
Oh, yeah.
Because even when I was directing, my directing style, I'd hop over and like show the person what I wanted to do. I also look back and notice when I would be in other, you know, you get in student films, you get four people together, right? One's going to be a DP, one's going to direct, one's going to act. A lot of the other students in film classes would ask me if I would be in front of the camera in their short film.
Okay.
Or scene or something like that. So. And I was happy to do that. I just think at that time, admitting to myself or anyone else, saying out loud that I really wanted to act in front of the camera, it just felt, something about it felt like a pipe dream, irresponsible, avant-garde, hippy-dippy idea that felt arrogant. And then like, who the hell do you think you are kind of idea. So I couldn't even really admit it. But obviously I wanted to do it. And ended up doing just that.
Yeah, hasn't worked out so bad for you. And no. You landed that role of Wooderson in Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused. And again, I remember what a big deal that movie was in Texas when it came out, how it kind of launched the whole indie film craze in Texas. And I love that the line that has continued to follow you your entire career, all right, all right, all right, that wasn't even in the script. In fact, you weren't even supposed to be in that scene, right?
No, there was no scene.
Mm-hmm.
I just showed up set to do what's called a makeup wardrobe test, meaning I had the job of Wooderson, and there were three lines that I in two different scenes that I was going to say. But those nights when I was supposed to work were like supposed to be 10 days later. This particular night, I just showed up to do makeup wardrobe test, which means you go through makeup, you go through wardrobe. I'm on the set. They're shooting other scenes with other actors. The director gets a break, comes over, looks you up and down. Linklater looks at me, says, oh, wow, man. Yeah, I like this. This is Wooderson. Cool hair. You got the peach pants. Oh, is that Ted Nugent? Oh, is that a pipe you got around your cool peach pants? Right on. Da, 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 da. And just as I'm about to leave, he goes, say, you know, Waterston's a cop guy. He's probably been with the typical hot chicks at high school, you know, cheerleaders, major red, stuff like that. He goes, do you think Waterston would be interested in the redheaded intellectual? I'm like, oh, yeah, man. You know, Waterston likes all types of chicks. He's like, yeah, well, Marissa Urbisi's over here. She's playing the role of Cynthia, the redheaded intellectual. You know, school's just ended, and nobody knows, maybe, you know, no one knows where the, if there's a party tonight, maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe pull up in the top notch, try and pick her up. I'm like, yeah. Well, the next thing I know, I'm sitting there about to shoot my first scene in a movie. There's nothing scripted. The scene is I'm going to pull up and try and pick her up and kind of let her know that there's a party later on tonight and where that party is, Moon Tower, right? And then, like I said, there's nothing written. I start to get a little bit anxious. So I'm sitting in my car and I'm starting to go, okay, who's my man? Who is Waterston? Who is Waterston? What is Waterston about? And in my mind, I said, well, I'm in my 70 Chevelle. There's one. In my mind, I said, Waterston's back getting high. I'm like, Slater's riding shotgun. He's always got a doobie rolled up. There's two. I said, Waterston's about rock and roll. I said, well, look, man, I got Ted Nugent Stranglehold in the 8-track right now, rocking to that. That's three. And then I hear action. And I look up and there's Cynthia over there, the redheaded intellectual. And in my mind, I say, and Waterston's about picking up chicks. Put it in drive, pulled out. In my mind, I said, you got three out of four going to get the fourth. All right, all right, all right. And that's where that came from. It was the three affirmations for the three things Waterston did have. Mm-hmm. Going to get the fourth. Batting 750, going to bat 1,000.
Yeah. Yeah, you say that in every script that you read, there's usually what you call a launch pad line that unlocks that character for you. What was the launch pad line for Dazed and Confused for Waterston?
No, the Waterston launch pad, I have one of those three lines, mm-hmm. classic line that Linkletter wrote, was there in front of the pool hall, and one of the high school girls goes by and Waterston kind of checks her out, and his buddy leans up to Waterston and says, Waterston, you got to cut that out, man. You're going to end up in jail. And Waterston says, no, man, that's what I love about those high school girls, man. I get older. They say the same age. Well, that line, I'm like, who's that dude? I mean, that line is not an attitude. If he's not trying to make a joke, if he's not like going, it's a different line. If you go like, no, man, that's what I like about the high school girls, man. I get older. They say the same age. Waterston, there's nothing cute about it. Waterston, that was like his POV. Like he felt like he had the world figured out. Like he was living his salad days. Like he was the king of his own throne. And so if you unpack, and I go, what the reason I call it a launch pad lines, because if you unpack, if someone takes a line like that literally, if a character like that is their ethos, you can write a book on somebody that person looks at the world in a completely unique way. That person goes home, does a, and you can think about where's that person live? That tells you about what their house looks like. That tells you what they drive. That tells you what kind of job they got. That tells you how far from home they'll go. You know, that it tells you all kinds of things. And so it really opened up to who Waterston was for me.
So then that leads to you going off to Hollywood, and you don't have the typical story of struggle and heartbreak that a lot of people have gone through. You landed an agent pretty much immediately and started getting roles in major movies. Then you land A Time to Kill, which I think was the big break for you. And you recall before that movie came out, you could go down Third Street Promenade in Santa Monica in total anonymity and be just fine. Yeah. Then suddenly that movie opens that weekend, and within a day or two, you can't go anywhere without being recognized. Did you adjust to celebrity?
So that's a 48 hour flip. The Friday before that movie opened, meaning it opens, say it opens tonight at 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. That Friday afternoon, before that 7 p.m. screening, the first screening of Time to Kill, I was still meeting strangers and in the world. I still had anonymity. The next Monday morning, I went back on that same promenade that Monday, it was actually Monday afternoon. So in less than 48 hours, the world had inverted. Everybody recognized me. I had no anonymity. The world was a mirror, meaning everyone all of a sudden had a biography of me. They're coming up going, oh my God, I'm so sorry about this hut.
Weird.
And you're like, well, number one, who are you? Number two, how'd you know I had a dog? Number three, how'd you know my name was Miss Hud? Number four, how'd you know she had cancer? Or you just skipped four things and jumped right into my life. You know what I mean? Or, oh my God, I love you. I love you. I love you. And where I came from, I'm like, but we don't throw those three words around. I've kind of said that to four people. You know what I mean? Do they mean it? Do they not mean it? What have you? All of a sudden, the roof was off on options for me work-wise. The world was a yes. Talk about it. The world was straight green lights. And when you have nothing but green lights, you got to look for at least the yellow to slow down and go, wait a minute, which one of these things do I really care about and what really matters? Meaning the Friday before Time to Kill opens, there's 100 scripts there. I would do anything to do any of those scripts. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And the answer for 99 of them is no, Matthew. Now, all of a sudden, Monday, the movie opens up. Movie does well. I'm famous. Those 100 scripts. Now, all those 99 are going, yes, do this one, please. And you're like going, whoa, 2 days ago, I'd have done any of these, and you wouldn't let me do any. And now you're telling me I can do all of them.
Yeah.
Like, can I get a little discernment here? You know, so I packed up, went off to a monastery for a while, shook the city off of me, tried to, you know, let my memory catch up and see what mattered to me. Then I packed up and took a 22-day solo trip to Peru. I've practiced those little walkabouts of solitude throughout my life, and they've been very valuable to me.
Yeah, it sounds like it. You also went to Africa for a little bit, right?
Yeah. We've been to Africa a couple times on those walkabouts.
Yeah. Now, for a number of years, you had this very healthy and lucrative career doing romantic comedies. Then it sounds like you kind of gave yourself your own red light when you got tired of doing romantic comedies, which paid very well. Yeah. You did something almost unheard of in the industry. You took a 20-month sabbatical from acting and just held out for the kind of offers that you really wanted. Now, that's a risky move. I mean, sometimes you do that and the town forgets about you. How did you keep your resolve for that long?
Well, the town did forget about me, and that's actually became the blessing, because at that time when I decided to take off, I was the rom-com guy. Like you mentioned, they were going well. I was getting paid handsomely for them. I was the go-to guy for the rom-coms. The movies were making money. They were making me a bunch of money, and I loved doing them. But they did so well, and I was so sort of pigeonholed as the rom-com guy. Any drama or anything else I wanted to do was like, absolutely not. No one would finance anything, no matter how much I'd take a pay cut. Certain dramas I wanted to do, they're like, nah, I want to do it, but not with McConaughey. He's the rom-com guy. He's, you know, he's shirtless on the beach, rom-com guy. So I noticed that, okay, if I can't do what I want to do, I'm going to at least stop doing what I've been doing. So after 20 months, and hell, I didn't know how long it was going to go on. 20 months, it could have gone on. I had 15 months into it without working and without a phone call or anyone interested in me working. No phone call from my life. Trust me, I'm calling my agent every week, and he's going, buddy, hadn't even heard your name. So I was forgotten. I start thinking, well, maybe that was it for me. I'm going to find a new career. Remember that orchestral conducting thing we talked about when we first started? maybe that's my future. You know, am I going to go be a teacher, a wildlife guide? Hell, I don't know. Music, but I thought about other jobs, careers, because I might not be invited back to Hollywood. So anyway, 20 months go by, and because I was forgotten, because you didn't see me in the theater or on your TV screen in another rom-com, you didn't see me, a picture of me shirtless on the beach for the paparazzi, because now I'm back in hiding out in Austin, Texas. All of a sudden, in my absence, I became a new novel. Good idea. Hey, you know who might be a great choice for this Lincoln lawyer? Killer Joe, Paperboy, Mud Bernie, Dallas Buyers Club, True Detective, Magic Mike. You know, Bernie. All of a sudden, these roles started coming to me, and I was a new novel, a good idea, which I wouldn't have been and was not 20 months earlier. So even in the audience's mind, not only the Hollywood's mind, but even in the audience's mind, I think the audience, the public, needed a break from seeing me as the rom-com shirtless guy on the beach, because there was so much of that. If you see me in these other roles, they're going like, I'm not quite buying it. You know what I mean? But to be gone, now we don't know, where is he? I haven't seen him. Oh, yeah, where's he been? Now you can come back as something different, which I did.
Yeah, I think you said you didn't rebrand yourself. You had to unbrand yourself, and that worked out pretty well.
rebrand. Yeah. So it was a 20-month unbranding phase to which led to then when things came my way that I wanted to do, those movies I just listed, that became the rebrand.
Yeah, and it's worked out great for you. You've had what someone, I think, at some point called the McConaissance. You had a number of great roles. And then, of course, Dallas Buyers Club. Now, you say in here that you had a tough time finding someone to make Dallas Buyers Club, or at least put up the money for it. How long were you guys trying to get that made?
Well, I was attached to it for years. Mm-hmm. I was attached to it before I took the 20-month sabbatical.
Oh, okay.
But nobody, even then, again, nobody, number one, to get a period piece age drama financed is not at the top of studios list. Okay. Yeah. They're going that. Well, okay. You know, they don't want to, that looks like a blockbuster. You know what I mean? So that's one, it's a hard movie to get made. Two, with me attached, even harder to get made at that time. Meaning plenty of directors came by, loved the script, but said, I'm not doing it with McConaughey in the lead. And so they moved on because I held the script. Some actors tried to get the script from me. I was like, this will have its day. I'm hanging on to this. I'm not giving this one up. And so after I come out, Connaissance is going on and making successful dramas. Even then, it's still very hard to get that movie made. Myself, we found the director, Jean-Marc Vallée. We found Robbie Brenner, the producers. We all got together and just basically just said amongst ourselves, we're doing this in, I think it was October of later this year. And this was around, I think, February-ish. And we were like, October, we're going to do it. Let's just start location scouting and just start telling everyone we're doing it. We knew we didn't have the money, but we were still like, we're doing it. We're just going to hook or by crook, we're going to make this happen. So through that year, a little bit of financing would come in here or there, but not enough to make the movie. And we just kept saying, yep, doing it in October. Even my agent behind closed doors would go, you keep telling people you're doing this thing in October, but you know there's no money to do it. And I was like, no, we're doing it. And he'd show me another script with a great offer, really good script. And like, I'd be like, when's it shooting? Before I'd even read it. He goes, well, they want to go in October. I go like, you know, I'm not doing anything else in October. I'm doing Dallas Buyers Club. Dallas Buyers Club in October. And he'd be like, you keep saying that, but it's not real. I'm like, yes, it is. Well, we just kind of didn't flinch. All of us as a team just marched forward and got money along the way. A Texas feed company came on with an extra $1 million a week before we started shooting to help us make the movie. And we made the movie with not as much money as we needed or was budgeted to make it. But the director, Jean-Marc Vallée, who's a wonderful director, like 8 days beforehand, because we didn't have enough money, he scrapped the entire grip team. And a grip team is the lighting team.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. How do you
there
know
wasn't
that?
One light on the set of Dallas Buyers Club. Not one light.
Really?
Not one light. It was all natural light. The only light we had was one night my driver and friend John Chaney pulled up. It was a trailer park scene, night scene. Pulled up and I got out and he left the car running. And when he left the car running, the high beams, the beams of his of the car were hitting the back of the trailer and going through the windows. Mm-hmm. And just as we started to go action, we're going to do the scene, he shut the car off. And the DP goes, no, where's this light? Where's this light? I like this light. And they ran over to him, the guy outside going, turn your car back on. That was the light.
Well, real quickly, as we wind down here, the idea has been floated of you running for office down in Texas. If you were to run, I don't really know where you fall politically. I suppose my default assumption with anyone from Hollywood is that you're going to be a progressive liberal. But then I can also see a strong libertarian streak in you. You know, if a guy wants to play bongos naked in his living room, you know, leave him the hell alone and let him do it. Am I right? Would you be an independent or what would you be if you ran?
You know, I don't know. I'm not going to write. I'm not comfortable affiliating myself with one party or the other right now. I think that's a small way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
At least for me, you know, I will say this. I think it's a very aggressive move, almost a dare right now to say, hey, I'll meet you in the middle. I'm going to come see over here just to have a look at each other's eye here for a second.
Right.
And I don't think that has to be a place that we consider, oh, that's compromise. Oh, that's the default move. Oh, that means I'm weak. Man, we're so far on the, you know, on the extremes now that it's almost like we don't even have true confrontation. And I think you got to have confrontation to have unity. All right. But we don't even hardly have true confrontation, because true confrontation, it leads, means you validate or legitimize the opposition's point of view that they are an opponent. And right now, especially in our political system, we almost say the if someone opposes our thoughts, we make them persona non grata. We actually illegitimize them.
We silo.
Give them no validation, call them evil, foolish, or what are you talking about? Condescend, patronize the hell out of them, because what do they think? And that's not true confrontation. Mm-hmm. You got to at least give credit to the point of view. And look, my hunch is that we can come together on some common denominator of values. All right. I don't even talk politics is maybe right now. I don't know if that's the category for with which to get things done. You know, I've said it before. It is a bit of a broken business. It needs to declare itself or redefine itself. And politicians need to redefine what it is. What's the purpose of politics? What's the real purpose of politics? So, yeah, that's the area that I stand.
Yeah. So what, governor? What if you were to run for something? What do you think?
Well, no, I don't know. I don't have any plans to run for anything. Okay. Like I'm saying, I don't know that. I'm interested in leadership roles in the future, but again, I don't know if that's in politics. Okay. I honestly go, how and where could I be most useful if I can supply something that would be demanded by people?
Yeah.
By people, Texans, Americans, or whoever. If I can supply something, that I think they go, "What, we demand that because we need that." Mm-hmm. I don't know. The politics is the category with which for me to disseminate that.
Okay.
And help lead. Okay. It could be. I just don't know that it is.
Yeah. Well, you do say that you collect bumper stickers. What do you think your campaign slogan would be if you were to run?
Oh hell, I don't know, man. I mean, look, like I said, man. Hey. I'll meet you in the middle. Someone sent me something the other night that said, here's your campaign slogan. Let's make America all right, all right, all right again. I'm like, well, that's kind of a low-hanging fruit. That would work.
That could work. or keep living. That's kind of just your mantra,
living.
Isn't it?
Keep living is the one. I mean, that's really the umbrella that all of them live under. Yeah.
Maybe keep living and leave me the hell alone.
Well, you know, I mean, It's a mix, though, isn't it? I mean, the leave me all the hell alone, I get it. At the same time, we've got to recognize that we are a collective more so than we do.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
true.
That does not mean, you know, that doesn't mean trespassing on each other's rights or it doesn't take away. I'm not talking about taking away individual freedoms, but we do need something. We do need to bind some social contracts with each other in, whether they're if they're unsaid. We need a bit of an understanding constitution that if you and I are hanging out and you and I shake hands on a deal, I want to be able to trust that you're not going to pick my pocket and screw me on the deal.
Right.
We looked at each other. And I mean, there's some certain things of decency and integrity and responsibility and accountability, even risk taking and sense of humor that we need to bind between us, an understanding that trust is so low right now. No one knows who the hell to trust, man.
Yeah.
We don't trust others. We don't trust ourselves. We don't believe in others. We don't have a consensus between of science or leadership. Who the hell are we listening to? And what happens then? Then we start going really individual, where I ain't listening to anybody. Yeah. And then that's not a great recipe if everyone becomes so selfish that they don't give a damn about each other at all.
Not at all. Not at all. And I love what you're saying here about, you know, instead of finding our tribes in politics, race, gender, finding our tribe in shared values. I think that's a pretty good message there. And, you know, hell, if you run, I'll go re-register back in Texas. Well, again, it's been a lot of fun. The book is called Green Lights. Matthew McConaughey. Thanks, man.
Appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Matthew McConaughey for coming on the show. Order his new book, Green Lights, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.